This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. From the gentle breezes to catastrophic storms, wind is the invisible force that shapes our world and increasingly our future. New York Times bestselling author Simon Winchester returns with The Breath of the Gods, a sweeping exploration of wind as both destroyer and savior, menace and miracle.
As hurricanes grow stronger and wind turbines spin faster, Winchester unpacks the history, science, and mythology of this unseen power moving through our lives. With his signature wit and curiosity, he invites us to consider how something we cannot see can determine so much of what we feel and fear on a changing planet. Simon Winchester, welcome to Cool Science Radio. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
It is very nice to be back. Thank you so much.
Your books, I mean, if you rattle off a list of your bestsellers from The Professor and the Madman, The Men Who United the States, The Map That Changed the World, Krakatoa, The Perfectionist, and many others, you are known for what we love so much on Cool Science Radio is bringing curiosity to topics through storytelling that make you want to just be enveloped in the story. And so too is this topic of wind. So can you start off by talking about the prevalence of wind and how much more we're experiencing now?
Well, that's the strange thing about your question and indeed why I wrote the book. It was because there was a piece in The Guardian about now 3 years ago saying that two studies, one I think in Copenhagen and one in Chicago, had shown definitively that the average wind speed in mainland Europe and in mainland North America had in the past 15 years declined by 10%, not increased, which is what you think is happening in Utah, but is actually stilling. And that's the phrase, we're in the grip of the great terrestrial stilling. And there are areas of the world which are suffering through what they call a wind drought. And although the winds at sea are as boisterous as ever, over the land surfaces, and this is now being expanded to include Africa and Latin America, not sure about Asia thus far, but the wind speed is going down. And why is this happening? Because we know that hurricanes and cyclones and typhoons and all these kinds of extreme weather, tornadoes, of course, are getting more fierce and more numerous. But as far as average winds are concerned, the opposite seems to be happening. And yet, I mean, during the time I was writing this book, it seems to be bouncing back. And they're now talking, it gets more and more ludicrous. They're talking about the great terrestrial reacceleration. No one's entirely sure what is happening, except the initial theory, why is the world's wind speed slowing down? And it seemed not a totally rational explanation, which is that the Earth's surface, the solid surface, is getting rougher. There are more skyscrapers, new forests, and so forth. And the wind, the air is not passing over the continental surface as smoothly as it used to. Whereas, of course, the sea is the same as ever. Quite honestly, this has been debated for now the last decade. It seems to be a feature of global warming, that the lower differential between the temperature of the poles and the temperature of the equator, as that's becoming smaller as the poles are warming up, then that's probably the reason why this stilling is occurring, if indeed it is. But anyway, that's the reason I wrote the book in the first place, exactly the opposite of what you're experiencing in Utah.
Simon, you weave together beautifully, by the way, history, science, and storytelling. How did you balance the scientific exploration of atmospheric physics with the human stories that brings this book so alive?
Well, it's totally nice of you to say that, but it was extremely difficult, I must say. I mean, it's easy enough. No, I didn't say easy enough. It's not too complicated to describe different types of winds and different types of circumstances. But when you get onto the physics of it, I mean, atmospheric physics and the whole business of the physics of turbulence, the fluid mechanics and so forth, that's mighty complicated for my little brain anyway. And so to deal with things like the Hadley cell and the Ferrell cell and the Rossby wave and all these phenomena which determine the major climatic patterns in the world, that I found tricky. And I tried to corral it into a section of the book where I, in a way, wanted to make the pages a different color and say, move on through this chapter really quickly and go to the next because it's a lot more interesting. But it had to be there to give the book credibility and heft with the scientific community. So I found it a challenge, and it was a relief when I got through it, and I had to show it to various atmospheric scientists to make sure I hadn't got it too howlingly wrong. And they all seemed to sign off and say, yeah, that was okay.
Wow. Well, speaking of the scientific community, was there a particular scientist or historical figure who stood out as especially visionary or perhaps misunderstood in shaping our understanding of air and weather?
Well, I have, oddly enough, I've been asked by a newspaper in London to select three books to do with weather. And one of them I'm most amused by, but in a very negative way. It's a book you shouldn't read, in a way. It's by a man called Ellsworth Huntington, Civilization and Climate. And it went into three editions. It was very popular in the 1920s and 30s. And it argued that humankind, the best of humankind, lives in regions of the world where there is varied climate. And in other words, there should be storms, and there should be heat and cold, and there should be high winds, and it challenges you all the time. You have to deal with a variety of hot summers and cold winters and so forth. The people who live in such areas are brighter, sharper, more intelligent. And people that live where the temperature is essentially the same all year round, the winds are mild, they are, by Ellsworth Huntington, he was a Yale professor, no fool, that they are necessarily duller. And the same applies in this field of thought to people living in different seismic zones. I mean, let's say people in San Francisco, where there's constant seismic activity, are, according to these thinkers, mercifully no longer exist, or their views are disdained, are cleverer than people who live in, let's say, Nebraska. So it's an interesting field of study, and his book is quite extraordinary, beautifully written and persuasive, but of course, utter rubbish. But he stands out as a figure in early weather science, who I think should be read to know what people thought 100 years ago.
Speaking of history, let's go into the history of wind. And it's funny, we know that today and very recently there's a war against wind power by some very powerful forces. And that's not the first time that there has been a war against wind power. You go back into the late 1800s. Tell us that story.
It's a remarkable man called James Blythe. He was a Scotsman, and like so many Scotsmen, a first-class engineer. I mean, Scots fanned all over the world. He was a professor of engineering at a university in Glasgow, and he had a little cottage on the North Sea in a village called Marykirk in Aberdeenshire. And put it in context, this was in the 1870s or 1880s. Faraday had adduced the principle that you can generate electricity or make electrons move by rotating a copper coil between the poles of a magnet. That was done. We know how to make electricity. Also, Thomas Edison had given us the light bulb, so we knew that you pass some of this electricity through a very fine filament and it'll light up. If you keep it in a vacuum, it'll remain for some weeks or months an instrument to light things with. So James Blythe thought, well, I can turn a spindle and generate electricity using wind power. I mean, just like a windmill. So he built one in the garden of his house in America, the one where there's constant wind from the North Sea. And it was an ugly contraption, as many of these pioneering things were, with sails of cloth, but it worked. And there was so it turned around and turned a spindle, which through an elaborate system of gearing turned a dynamo, which indeed generated direct current, which he fed into an accumulator, which is an early form of battery, and stored, he had electricity in as a box, and connected it by wire to these. He had about 25 electric light bulbs, and lo and behold, they all lit up. And all of a sudden, he didn't have to rely on kerosene or a wick and a candle. He could switch on and switch off lights, which would be reliable, and he could read at night in bed, and he could dine and illuminate his house. I mean, the gloom of a Scottish night is a formidable thing. He cut through it. And the extraordinary thing was that he made so much of this electricity, by the simple act of having a windmill make it for him, that he was able to offer it to his neighbors. So he went down the street and said, I can give you bulbs and I can give you accumulators full of electricity. You can live as I'm living. And they, to a man, said, no, Dr. Blythe, very nice of you to offer it, but it's the work of the devil. What? He said, yes. He said, electricity should only be generated by coal, which is underpins most of that part of Scotland. He said, from the wind, it's not godly. And so they refused, and in the end, he made one other wind generator, and he was put on the roof of a lunatic asylum not far away from where he lived. Only the mad would accept his gift. And what it shows is that who was opposing him? It was the fossil fuel lobby, just as they are doing today. The coal and oil interests are doing their level best through the current occupants of the White House to end wind energy, which to me is a thing of utility and it's essentially free and blah, blah, blah. So it was ever thus. The coal lobby, very, very powerful in the 1880s, just as it is in the 2025s.
That's incredible. Just incredible. Well, let's talk about some of the opposition to wind power now. There are some really bad arguments out there against wind power. My favorite bad argument is it kills a lot of birds. Talk about some of the bad arguments and some of the reasonable arguments.
Well, I mean, whales is another thing. And they say that the whales are somehow driven mad by the constant beat of the offshore wind platforms. There is no evidence for that. There's no evidence for the mighty killing of birds. Yes, you can say some people will find them ugly, I dare say, but it seems to me that this, you're not going to interrupt the wind. You don't interrupt the wind. The downstream effect, 50 miles beyond a wind farm, the wind is blowing just as substantially, just as heroically as it was before it met this great barrier of wind turbines. So it seems that so huge are the forces of the wind that our extraction of energy from them does essentially no damage at all to the passage of the wind generally. So we've got it for free, apart from, of course, building the turbines themselves. And the Chinese particularly are building enormous turbines and being sensible and thinking in the long term, we have this enormous capacity for doing, are generating more and more and more. And I believe you would have seen more recently than I that the amount of electricity globally generated by sustainable things like water and wind, solar, is now outstripping fossil fuels. So they're losing. But in this country, because the interests, the vested interests, are so enormous, particularly with oil, which retains a grip, of course, on the automobile industry, they're flexing their muscles as much as they can. But their time is over. There is no doubt. I'm not being Greta Thunberg. This is a simple economic, demographic reality. Oil and coal are dead. Wind and solar, to a lesser extent, I think, because that has considerable environmental problems, and hydro are there in the ascendant, as they rightly should be.
I love how you write about the intersection between nature's power and human curiosity. I'm curious. What does your relationship with air tell us about human ambition and human limits?
Gosh, well, it's a big subject. I think it was Thor Heyerdahl, the explorer of the Pacific, who remarked that man hoisted a sail long before he made the first wheel. And that seems true, that when, particularly in Mesopotamia, which is the beginning of most things, leaving aside the anthropological realities of East Africa, but civilization properly began between the Tigris and the Euphrates. And when these people, the Sumerians, the Chaldeans, so forth, found themselves beside the river, it was, of course, tempting to get in, stride a log and ride down, but you had no control where you went. And then someone had the bright idea of putting a mast up and attaching an animal skin to it. And all of a sudden, he can navigate. He can turn the sail this way and that and go to the far bank or wherever he wants. And the realization that you can use this invisible force that you don't know what it is, you don't know how it originated, but you can make use of it to go places. It's one of those remarkable discoveries, utterly simple and yet profound in its implications. And it spread to Egypt and Felucca, the single masted sailboat that you see when you go to Luxor and places like that, can go all the way downstream with the current, all the way from Luxor to Alexandria, but more importantly, using the wind and learning how to tack and do all the various things that sailors do, can go up back against the stream. And so this kind of profundity led to exploration, all the various benefits and disbenefits, of course. Travel, we didn't. People were nomads, but they were settled agriculturalists. But this was an easy, relatively easy way to travel. First of all, in the inland seas and the lakes and the rivers. And then, of course, when the Phoenicians managed to sail their boats using wind power, using easterly winds to go through the Pillars of Hercules out into the Atlantic Ocean, then the world was their oyster, quite literally, literally. And ultimately, then the Americas were discovered with India, China, and all the rest of it. And I shouldn't say discover, they were, people went there and found their opposite numbers who were already there, of course. But the world became, and there was interchange of all sorts of things. Yes, there were wars and so forth, that's true. And of course, Pascal said that man's principal problem is his inability to remain settled comfortably reading in the peace and quiet of his own living room. The moment he stepped out, he created problems. Well, of course, one of the ways he stepped out was to use wind to help him go places. So one might argue that it wasn't all gravy. There was a lot of disadvantage to travel, but on the whole, travel is a good thing, I think.
Wow. So wind has provided a lot more than just power. It's provided exploration and expansion. So.
And colonialism. I mean, you look at the pattern of how the Portuguese and some of the original European colonists, I mean, the pattern of their exploration of the world, Angola, Mozambique, and then this dotting of little territories all across the Indian Ocean as the winds push them ever east around the world, the westerly is the dominant winds of the world, were colonial forces.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are having a fascinating conversation with New York Times bestselling author Simon Winchester, who is talking to us about his latest book, The Breath of the Gods, a sweeping exploration of wind as both destroyer and savior, menace and miracle. Simon, the title itself, The Breath of the Gods, it's both poetic and scientific at the same time. Can you tell us how you landed on that title and what it signifies to you?
All the early civilizations who recognized the existence of wind, and of course it's hard not to recognize the existence when air is moving fast around you and pushing you along or bringing down trees or whipping up dust devils in the sand, what is its origin? And there was no rational explanation except for one, which I'll mention in a second. But among our old friends in the Tigris and Euphrates valleys, and then in Egypt, and then in the Indus Valley in India, and then in China, the Huanghe, the Yellow River, the only explanation that was available and that was written about, and so we know about it today, was that this was a divine power. It had its origin somewhere up there. It was God or the gods doing something. You know, thunder was moving the furniture. We know that as children, but the wind was caused by the gods breathing in and out. But the one person that didn't, there were many, of course, but the one person who wrote it down, as he wrote so much, and this would be, 2,800 years ago, 300 BCE, was Aristotle. And Aristotle, in this huge volume, Meteorologica, wrote that wind must be caused because warm air rises, and so cool air has to rush into the void it leaves behind. And the movement of the air coming in to fill the void caused by wind going upwards, or air going upwards, that is wind. And he got it right. I mean, so long ago, one's admiration for Aristotle is boundless. He got it right, and everything, wind is defined as the movement of air. Well, why does it move? It's nothing to do with gods, except, I dare say, in a meta sense. No, it moves because of heat. And the two components that are essential for creating wind are an atmosphere and then something, a source of heat that causes the atmosphere to move. That's what wind is. And it's interesting that when humankind explored the moon in 1969, it has no atmosphere, it has no wind. And yet the Americans, they had to put up a flag. And so NASA designed a flagpole for Neil Armstrong to plant on the surface of the moon, which had two components, a vertical component and a horizontal one. But the horizontal bar of aluminium had a little kink in it. So when you threaded the flag onto it, it looked as if it was blowing in the wind. And so when Buzz Aldrin took the photograph of Neil Armstrong saluting, or the other way around, it looks as if the wind was blowing on the surface of the moon and the flag was, Old Glory was fluttering in that wind. Well, it wasn't. And the irony is that when the lunar lander then took off to take them back into orbit, back home, the blast from the rockets created the only wind the moon has ever known, and it blew the flag over.
That's such a funny story, and I've never really thought about it before. A flag isn't a flag without wind, really. It just hangs there. That's very interesting. Well, gosh, we could talk to you forever about this, and there's so many stories we won't get to, and that's why we all must read your book, The Breath of the Gods. But before we let you go, I just have to ask about going back to sort of our global wind patterns. And of course, Hurricane Melissa that just came through Jamaica. I think I read it. The highest wind was 185 miles per hour. Not the highest wind on record, but one of the strongest hurricanes on record. What does it say? I mean, hurricanes are also anecdotally, maybe I'm just saying this anecdotally, but also increasing in intensity. So going back to the very first comment you made about the stilling of winds on Earth or on land, how does that all figure in?
Well, believe you me, it's a subject of intense study. I think the feeling is that the stilling thing was a temporary aberration. That's my inclination. I mentioned the late, great global reacceleration. That's what actually is happening.
Okay.
Why are hurricanes, typhoons, cyclones, and tornadoes becoming more numerous and more dangerous? I mean, the depressions that cause specifically the hurricanes getting deeper, things that the lowest temperature, lowest barometric pressure you would ever find would be in the 1920s or something, is now dipping below into the 800s. And that is a serious problem. And the assumption has to be our old friend global warming, that it is causing the sea temperature to be higher and higher, and we could talk endlessly about the Coriolis force and so forth, causing swirling motion, and the swirling getting more intense. There's more fuel to get this, keep this thing whirling round and round and round, faster and faster and faster, and causing a deeper hole, as it were, in the atmosphere as it gets more and more intense. So it's a complicated field, and as I mentioned a few moments ago, it's the mathematics. We'd all defeat most sentient human beings, I think. It's all the work. I mean, it's no secret that nearly all the major meteorological laboratories all over the world employ supercomputers, I mean, titanic computers, to work out what's going on from all the observation. And then you've got the jet stream. I don't want to say that this is the end of things, but the measurement of the jet stream when it was first discovered in the 1930s by a wonderful Japanese scientist who sent up balloons to determine the speed of wind at various altitudes. Once you get into the lower stratosphere, he suddenly found there was this enormously strong, principally westbound wind, which he realized was a different phenomenon. And he called it the jet stream. And he wrote very excitedly a paper, The Discovery of the Jet Stream. It was published in a highly respected journal, but no one responded. And he thought, this is puzzling, did it again. He wrote 18 papers, all about different nuances, different aspects of the jet stream. But nobody ever got in touch and said, this is an extraordinary discovery. And the reason no one got in touch is that this gentleman didn't write his paper in either English or Japanese. He wrote it in Esperanto, president of the Japanese Esperanto Society. And he thought as this was a global phenomenon, it should be written in a newly invented global language. It was a major mistake. And it wasn't until, regrettably, the Americans wrote about it in English in the early 1940s that people realized what the jet stream was.
I wonder how many readers and speakers of Esperanto there were at that point in time. That's ridiculous.
The Japanese Esperanto Society is still alive and well. I rang them up and spoke to them in English, I have to say. And no, there are 80 chapters, and they memorialize this man, Dr. Oishi, who discovered the jet stream. Oh, he was a heroic figure. This paper, written in 1936 or something, is the true discoverer. He should have gotten an award for it, but sadly, linguistically, somewhat misunderstood.
Well, the book is The Breath of the Gods, and our guest has been Simon Winchester, who is joining us again on Cool Science Radio. We're so pleased that we could speak with you this morning, Simon. Thank you so much.
It's a delight. Nice to talk to you again. Thank you.